This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Presented by OnX Hunt, creators of the most comprehensive digital mapping system for hunters. Download the Hunt app from the iTunes or Google Play Store. Know where you stand with OnX. You know, we had a guy write in that he's a nudist. You know?
Do I know what a nudist is?
Yeah, my kids the other day were wondering what nudists were, and I had to explain it to them.
How much time do you have to spend in the nude to be a nudist?
That's what I don't understand.
What percentage of the day?
When I was talking to my kids, I left it to be that a nudist, I kind of left it to be that like a nudist would be someone who would sort of go out of their way to do their chosen activities in a place that would allow them to do them nude. Like that was sort of where I drew.
It is nude when possible.
Oh, you just looked it up?
I watched the intro of a nudist documentary.
Oh.
That's as far as I got. Nude that, when possible.
Yeah, but that makes me largely a nudist.
No, because you'd be nude right now.
No, I'd get in all kinds of trouble, like from an HR type thing. Phil doesn't need to. Phil would complain probably.
The Oxford Dictionary just defines it as a person who does not wear any clothes because they believe this is more natural and healthy.
Yeah, you know, I'm not a nudist, but what got us talking about with our kids is I was explaining to them that there's a thing that happens, like, because like they were kind of wondering, like, why do they wear pajamas? I'm gonna get to this nudist that wrote in, but they're talking about like, why do we wear pajamas? And I said that people tend to begin life in pajamas, and they end life in pajamas, but then there's a long, long window in the middle when you don't wear pajamas.
I think that's accurate.
Like you spend decades not in pajamas. I don't know like when it ends and begins, but you start and end in PJs.
Yeah, if I wear them now, it's more like to have a Sunday brunch or something, you know, at the house.
Yeah, I haven't owned a pair of pajamas probably since I like got rid of my Superman pajamas. Reason I'm writing about this guy is he elk hunts in the nude. He says he says I've hunted with trad bows, compound bows, rifles. Being nude is the most difficult obstacle I've thrown at myself.
I like this guy.
He checked into it. Says his nudity is completely legal where he hunts. He says you have to be very careful about where you pick. He leaves his shoes on. He says he's been a nudist for many years. And he says one of the main things that you wouldn't think about is just your awareness of wind direction. Is enhanced.
You got a lot of receptors.
Yeah. He says it's very freeing. And he says you pick your routes very carefully.
Has he had any kills in the nude?
I don't think so. He's got a nudist friend who also hunts. Different state, also hunts naked.
I wonder if they have to wear Hunter Orange during a modern firearm season.
You get that body paint, man.
that's all they wear.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Bart George. Bart, how's it going?
It's going well.
I'm going to, we got a couple things to cover before we start talking about your work, your recent work. But so all the caribou, last time we had you on, we talked about mountain caribou that are in the lower 48, which have at the time had like shrank until there was kind of a couple in Idaho.
Yeah,
they're gone.
They are gone.
Like gone.
We're pretty sure they're gone. Yeah. We did get a little surprise. Oh, I can't even remember when it was. It's been 18 months or so ago. A couple of caribou turned up in northern Montana.
Yep.
Just a fleeting glimpse, you know. They passed through, got, you know, photographs. They were able to document them and then never saw them again.
Where do you think they came from?
Probably out of the Purcells, but nobody really knows. So that's the last caribou documented in the lower 48, and they were actually in Montana.
What year was that?
like I said, it was about 18 months ago, I think. It was okay. right when the Selkirk herd was just
Yeah, I remember seeing that they had turned up there, and I never really heard what the story was.
Nobody knows the story. There's no conclusion to that story. They just disappeared.
What was the nail in the coffin for the Selkirk?
We're not exactly sure. There was, death? You know, there's, I think when we talked, there was, a dozen caribou left in that herd. And we were putting together a big project to do a maternal pen and put together a whole bunch of pretty heavy-handed management actions. And that March, when we were about to really get going with captures and stuff like that, we started our census and we only found 3 cows. Obviously, none of them were pregnant. So that everything got put on hold. We completed our census, only found the 3. We found 3 over in the Purcells. I think 2 of them were bulls. So we decided we better get those animals together and moved them all north up to Revelstoke and put them in the maternal pen that they have in place up there. Put collars on them, obviously, and then actually, it was a kind of a stroke of luck. One of the resident animals from the Revelstoke area dropped down close to the penning site about the time they were being placed, and they captured her and put her in the pen to kind of help them acclimate or whatever, hopefully they'll mother up to her. And that did work. They followed her back up to the top, and as far as we know right now, they're alive and doing well in that herd.
Wow.
So the last of the Selkirk Mountains don't live, or last of the Selkirk caribou don't really live in the Selkirks anymore. They're up north.
Man, I invite people. What was the name of that episode, Bart, when we covered this whole thing?
Oh, I don't know. It was
we always give them cutesy, clever names that are hard to remember.
Yeah.
Just give me a second.
I think it was number 43, but I'm not sure.
A guy I know that works at Old Town Canoes sent me this article about a dude, a hunter who became the first World Slam recipient across 4 categories. So everyone knows that I happen to be a turkey Super Slam holder. Now, almost 2-time Super Slam holder. What that is I have gotten, there's this notion that there are 5 subspecies of wild turkeys, and they live in different places, you know, and I've gotten them all. And once I get another Florida one, I'll be a 2-time Super Slam holder. A World Slam holder is a fella who gets all 5 of the, you know, all 5 of our wild turkeys, and then goes down to get this all 5 subspecies of our just, you know, American wild turkey. And then you go down to Central America or, you know, Belize, Southern Yucatan area, and you get yourself what's called an oscillated turkey, which is a whole different species of turkey. At the point you get an oscillated turkey, you become a World Slam holder. And there's an article about this dude, and what's really funny is he's standing there doing a grip and grin with a turkey, and it described, the caption says that it's a deceased. So he's holding his turkey. It says he poses with a deceased oscillated turkey. Deceased. But this is what the dude did, though. This is kind of like, I can't tell if I think this is the greatest or what thing. So he's done the World Slam. So all 5 North American, you know, all 5 American wild turkey subspecies. And then the oscillated turkey. He's got 4 times he's done it with a bow, a crossbow, a modern firearm, and a muzzleloader. So he's like a 4-time, like, I don't know at what point you're hunting turkeys and at what point you're just sort of checking things off a list. I don't know.
I think he's still hunting turkeys. I mean, he's out there having fun, still chasing gobblers every time, just choosing a different fire. I saw, it wasn't a grip and grin, it was a picture of a dead turkey today on Instagram, and it was with a pistol shotgun, and I was like, that's cool.
I could get into that,
you know, because it's obviously shorter range, you know, easy to pack around.
Took the dude a decade to get it done. So that's what, I wish I was better at math. 6 times 4.
24.
24. So he's getting 2.4 turkeys per year to work toward his deal. That makes it seem very achievable.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, not crazy hard on the pocketbook either, if you think of it that way.
No. Mike Petraska.
Congrats, Mike.
That's good. When I retire, man, I'm going to be hot on that dude's heels. Oh, you know, this is the last thing I'm going to bring up, and this is the last part, the last installment of our, I shouldn't say our, the ongoing story of like our flip-flops appropriate footwear. This has been beaten to death. But do you got room for one last?
Sure. You never know. You might learn something.
So, dude, he's out like supposedly scouting for turkeys, and which he says comes down to sitting in the back of a truck, drinking beer, listening for gobbles at night. And his dog, he doesn't put an e-collar on his dog, and his dog just decides to get up and take off and heads out into a swamp. He's got his flip-flops on. So the dog goes off in the swamp, and it's like knee-deep muck, and because he has his flip-flops on, he can't go in there after it. But his buddy, who's got sneakers on, goes in there after it. The guy with the flip-flops takes his flip-flops off so he can run and runs around on the road, and in so doing encounters the neighbor and scores a hunting permission on the neighbor's place. So it's sort of like an inadvertent effect. You wearing flip-flops, Cal?
Oh, yeah.
Cal's got them on right now.
It's flip-flop season.
An inadvertent upside to run around in flip-flops. A couple things I want to talk about too real quick. Back when people used to just freely fly around the country on airplanes.
Back in the long, long ago.
Yeah. When I was a boy, you just would get on an airplane and just go where the hell you felt like.
No mask, nothing.
I travel a lot with Yanni, and I keep wanting to bring this up with Yanni. I realize Yanni is a, he's like a chatter. Like, you like to chit-chat with your seatmates.
Hmm.
More so than I'm comfortable doing.
Oh, more so than you, that's for sure.
And I never like brought this up with you, but like Giannis is talking to someone, they're talking behind me, and I can hear him talking, and Giannis telling them all about just different stuff and what he's coming from doing. And Giannis gets to talking about game meat, wild game meat, and I laughed about this because the woman he's sitting next to tries to up him. And I even wrote it down in my notes where she told him, "My favorite meat of all time is kangaroo."
Yep. I remember that too. Cause I didn't realize you were sitting in front of me until much later in the flight. But I remember when she said that, I said, "Is that right?" And then I opened my book and
she's like, "Don't you be telling me about this wild game." You know, I also heard this dude, like this interesting story on an airplane not long ago, one of my final flights. And the guy was like, we were on a plane. There's a bunch of dudes going down to, we were coming home from Bemidji, Minnesota. And there was a bunch of Minnesota dudes going down to watch their team do spring training in Florida, which that is a trip I cannot imagine.
Did you know that people did this prior to that?
No. No. They're real excited. They're traveling down to watch people practice playing baseball in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
But he was observing to someone how the area where their Minnesota team carries on this activity, that he was talking about how it got built up over the years. And he was saying how it used to be when you went down there, it was all cows. And now it's all buildings. And I started thinking about that. Remember the old Cows Not Condos?
The bumper sticker? Yeah, you still see a few around this town.
I never think of that like applied to Florida.
Mm.
But like that the cattle operations replaced by just buildings. I look at like every day I look friendly. When I look at cows, I feel like more affection toward them than normal over time. So Bart, what's going on, man? What else is happening? We got a bunch of stuff to talk to you about your mountain lion, your crazy mountain lion projects.
Yeah, that's been the highlight of my spring. The COVID stuff is everything kind of weird right now at work. But
are you able to get out and do your work still?
Kind of. Not as much as I'd like. I'm really working like 2 or 3 days a week, we don't have childcare available, so my wife and I are kind of fighting over who gets to go to work and who stays home with the kids.
Got it.
Both of us are supposed to be doing our jobs. But we do have callers out working, but we're still generating quite a bit of data.
Like you have callers on how many mountain lions?
We have 5 callers out right now. But so these callers are on a 5-week rotation. So I really don't want more than about 4 or 5 because we have to see every one of these cats every week, and that's quite a bit of work, you know, capturing 5 cats a week.
Homie, you got to go catch the cat and mess with it every week to put a new collar on it?
We don't have to put a new collar on it. Once it's collared, though, we revisit that cat once a week, tree it, basically, approach it and tree it.
To do what?
Just to grab that data point. So we're measuring the distance. I can get into the details now if you want on
You're getting a little far ahead of yourself.
Am I? Okay. But I'm not getting into the details of what you're doing yet. I'm just trying to understand. In this day and age, I thought you just put them on it and then you just sit back and reap the information.
The collar and faller research. No, we're not doing that. This is pretty hands-on as far as big cat research goes. So we're looking at these cats every week and we are then measuring their response to that.
Okay. So let's back up.
Yeah. We can't start there.
Okay. You tell me where to start.
Well, I can tell you about the project.
Yeah, tell me about the project.
So the reason the project is occurring because we're seeing lots of depredations. We're seeing lots of cats hanging around ex-urban, urban interface areas.
Depredations on what?
Typically small livestock and pets. Typically the way those work, a cat kills whatever, X number of sheep or a couple of llamas or whatever, eats its fill. Caches the carcass, near the pasture usually, and then just lays around, comes back and feeds that night. By the time we get the call, usually it's a day or two. And we started noticing that the cats are right there. Like we would turn the dogs loose from the carcass and they'd have the cat caught in like 30 seconds sometimes. Cat would be laying 200 yards away, bedded someplace near the carcass. Totally not concerned about us pulling in with the pickups and our voices and the dogs making a racket on the box and barking and everything else that's going on. So it kind of got me wondering, like, what's it take? Why are these cats not concerned about all of this goings on that's happening so close to them? Why aren't they running away from all that noise? And then, the next question was, how close can we get to these cats? If we don't know it, how close are we walking up to these cats and maybe never knowing it?
Hold there, because I got a couple questions.
All right.
When they kill someone's dog, is a dog small enough where they don't kind of like eat some and stash it and then come back and feed on it some more? Or do you see them doing that with house dogs?
Well, it depends on the size of the dog. A small dog, they'll just pick up and walk off with. Oftentimes, we don't find a carcass cached away if it's a dachshund or something. We have found big dogs. We had a pit bull that was killed and mostly eaten, and that cat hung around on that carcass for a couple of days eating it before we caught him.
And that was some dude's dog?
Yeah, it was actually a service dog.
Really? Like a full-on service dog?
Yeah, they let it out to pee in the middle of the night, and the cat was just laying there waiting and grabbed it and packed it up the hill a few hundred yards and ate him. Obviously a cat like that I wouldn't want in my study. I get a little owly about running dog killers, because we're running them with dogs. I don't want one of my hounds to get out in front and encounter a bad cat like that.
And then tell me where this is kind of happening, where you're doing your work, just so people understand like where we are on the map.
We're up in Northeast Washington. So Spokane, Washington is where I live, north all the way to Canada, and then out towards like Lake Roosevelt, Lincoln County. So we have a 5-county area that we're kind of working in.
Okay.
Pretty rural, Bart?
Yeah, pretty rural. We have cats close to town. Had a cat collar like 10 minutes away from my house. And like I said, I'm right on the north side of Spokane. You could see the city from where that cat lived. We have another one right now that's working over by like Mount Spokane ski area between there and the city. So rural, but not remote. Definitely that kind of wildland urban interface, you know, ex-urban, however you want to describe it.
A lot of whitetails, you know, too, right?
Lots of whitetails, lots of edge habitat.
Turkeys in North Spokane, too, yeah.
A lot of turkeys there. But yeah, just broken landscape, a lot of small landowners, 10 and 20 acre parcels are very common.
When you say dog killers, have you found like habitual dog eating cats, like cats that have kind of started to specialize on pooches?
I don't think that they have started to specialize on hunting and, you know, preying on dogs, but I think cats do start to figure things out once they work, and it might have been with a coyote or something, but sometimes I think those cats do figure out that they can turn and fight a single dog and pretty easily take care of that problem.
Gotcha.
Do you see where they kill many lions or llamas? Because that's the thing. If I was a mountain lion, man, I wouldn't eat anything but llamas.
Big neck. A lot of neck to work
with. Yeah, when they get them, do they get them? They just twist that neck.
Oh, yeah. They grab that big, long neck anywhere. I think it's probably works for them. We see a lot of llamas, yeah. A lot of alpacas, too, which I guess are slightly smaller than a full-size llama. We had one cat. It was a big, young tom, 160-pound tomcat, and he's only like 3 years old, right outside of Spokane, that killed 14 alpacas.
Jeez.
Over the course of
about... The sweaters you could make with that.
And they were... It was a strange one, because that cat must have spent quite a bit of time there. He had moved between three different pastures to kill all these alpacas. So
over what period of time did it take him to kill all those alpacas?
I think just overnight. But it was like a battle scene. There's just carcasses everywhere. It was awful.
Do you notice how surplus, like, there's people that, there's, depending on how you feel about predators, right? Depends on whether you embrace or try to deny the thing of surplus killing.
Yeah, it's well documented with livestock. We see I would venture guess more than half of our depredations right now are multiple animals.
What do you think? I know you don't know what he's thinking, but what is he thinking when he wants to kill, when he goes and kills 14 alpacas? Is it just that he's wired to, you know, like, it's opportunity, and he can't really picture his future food needs? Or is he like, this is a hoot, this is great fun?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make sense for him, right? Like
all the risk.
I would look at that as a savings account if I was a lion and just come back when I was hungry, but rather than kill them all at once. Yeah, I don't know what he's thinking. I think it's just irresistible. I think all those animals running around in a frenzy, and they're sort of in a, you know, a frenzy themselves, and I don't think they can help themselves at that point.
How is he killing the alpacas?
Typically bites to the neck and head. Not typically, almost every single time bites to the neck and head.
Was the owner of the alpacas pretty distraught?
Yeah, they were distraught.
My brother would I can't imagine. He'd be catatonic, man, if he came out and all of his llamas are dead.
Yeah. Well, there's a financial value, right? But the bigger thing is a lot of these animals, they have a lot more value than just the finances there. A lot of these people count on their goats and their sheep for meat or for 4-H show animals for their kids and other things. Most of our depredations aren't on big, like, whatever, corporate ranches or something. These are like 10-acre places with a couple of animals and, you know, that they use to feed their family or do whatever with. So... yeah, typically the landowner is pretty upset about it.
How do people, the people that lose their dog, do they tend to be, this is like, I'm just asking for a gross generalization here. Do people that lose their dog tend to be circumspect and sort of be like, well, he's just, that lion's just trying to make a living and, you know, I can't really blame him? Are they like, do they want blood? Do they want its head on a spike? Like, what's their general demeanor?
Most of the time, if it's a dog, like, you know, particularly a pet dog, not a working dog, people are pretty fired up. They want that cat dead. That's been our experience. We have, you know, that's the other issue. When they kill dogs, it's hard for us because, you know, if they kill a goat, most people, you know, they understand what we're doing and, you know, that we're going to catch this cat and probably kill it. So they'll let us leave that goat tied out. You know, we'll tie it to a tree, put a, you know, trail camera on it. We'll come back the next morning, and if that cat's hit it, we'll go catch it and kill it. It's hard to talk somebody into letting us do that with their dog.
Tying the dog to a tree.
Yeah, they don't want their dog to be used as bait. And I understand that. I would be that way too. So, yeah, dogs are a little different than small livestock typically.
You got to wonder if a cat starts out with a llama or an alpaca as prey species, if that cat tries to move on to something else, it has a very steep learning curve ahead of it due to the margin of error. For the length and size of the neck.
Oh, like, yeah, like an alpaca in a little teeny enclosure. Yeah. I could kill it with my teeth. You know? Like,
just got to get it in the neck. Now move over to a badger that has no neck.
I don't know. I don't think that there are very many lions that get that opportunity enough. You know, if they kill an alpaca, typically, we have to respond pretty quickly. I say we. It's really the WDFW enforcement that responds. And then you guys met Bruce.
Oh, yeah.
Bruce does a lot of those. I help with as many as I can, and we go out and help enforcement take care of that cat.
And can you guys do anything with the carcass at that point? Do you guys...
Not really. Unfortunately, most of those animals, sometimes if the landowner has a tag or wants a cat, sometimes they can get it if they request that animal. But typically, no. We've had a handful of them donated to the tribes. You know, the tribes will make use of that cat and the meat and the hide and the bones and different things.
What do you do with them? Just burn them up?
Yeah, they just go in the dump with the roadkill deer and everything else.
And people don't fish them out of the dump.
Well, maybe they do. I wouldn't know if they did. I don't know.
Man, I don't want to say who this was, but a good friend of mine, he, when he was in college, he was working on these net surveys, these fish surveys, mm-hmm. where they'd go out and set nets in lakes. And what they were supposed to do is they're not supposed to use the fish. They had to just dump the fish because they'd put out gill nets for surveys.
Ugh.
And he would, they'd go out in the work truck and dump the fish. He'd come home, get his regular vehicle, wait an hour, and go back and get the fish, and then take the fish back home and flay them and freeze them.
Sure.
Couldn't bring himself to dump those fish.
What kind of fish are we talking about?
He liked it. He was kind of a whitefish specialist. He liked to go get the whitefish out of there, but other stuff too.
Yeah.
Yeah. His initials were MD. And he had a 30-30, so we called him MD-30-30. Yanni, you had a point.
I did?
You were going to say something. Yanni's taken to stroking his beard.
Yeah, because again, it's not something I'm used to. it's like he found a new thing on his
face.
No, I don't think I did. I just happened to glance over at you, and you happened to be glancing this direction.
Oh, no. I thought you had a thing you started to say. Maybe you didn't. Oh.
I spoke to, on the disposal side of things, I spoke to a Montana game warden, longtime game warden, and somebody in his area hit a abnormally large black bear and killed it. And he went to his normal disposal site, which was a sharp turn on the highway, where he'd give critters the heave-ho because he couldn't stomach taking them to a dump. He thought it was too disrespectful to take animals to a dump.
Just throw them in with all the plastics and shit like that.
Yeah,
I got you.
But he didn't. He said his physics were a little off on just how big this bear was, and so he slid it out of the back of the truck down the mountain. It went, and he drove off. And the next day, he got from the town police department. He got a phone call saying, "Hey, we have a very large black bear that must have rolled off the mountain above town that is now on the bike path."
It did the whole hill.
It did the whole hill.
Remember that chainsaw commercials like that? Like some dude coming down the switchbacks and his chainsaw rolls out the back of his truck, and eventually he like finagles his way down all the switchbacks, and there's his saw laying in a mud puddle still running.
Yes.
Is it running? No, it was not running. He picks it up and starts it with one crank.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay, so here you are. You got a dead alpaca tied to a tree. Bart.
Yeah. that's about it. So when we show up the next morning, typically the cat comes back and feeds overnight. We check trail camera if we have one out. If we don't, we just walk dogs over to the alpaca and turn loose from that spot. And it's kind of, you know, without snow, it's typically just up to the dogs to figure out the in track and the out track, which way the cat came from and went. But what we're seeing is these cats are just laying around pretty close to us the whole, just listening. And we're not sneaking around out there. We're at a house. We're at a farm with a dog box in the back of the truck and yapping dogs and people talking at normal voices. And it was shocking how close the cats would be to us sometimes. We would hear, there were times where we heard the jump race where the dogs ran into the cat while he was just laying around in a bed listening to this whole racket that we were making.
And is that, would that not be like when you, 'cause you like to run lions. That was a hell of a start to a sentence. Listen, you like to run lions out in the very remote wilderness areas too now and then.
Right.
Is that not the same though there? Like when you find where he just killed an elk, is he more inclined to, as you approach, scoot out? Like, is this something that's peculiar? Is this a behavior that you were curious about because you felt that it was counter to what you'd see in other areas, or aren't you factoring in the proximity to the proximity to a suburb or people? Does that make any sense?
We don't know.
That was a bad sentence.
I think I can clarify. I think what you're saying is that you were oblivious to it, right? And you were only realizing this because some of those cats were collared.
We'd realize it when the dogs would jump that cat so close to us.
Oh.
But it got me wondering, like, what would it take for this cat to be afraid of people? Like, we don't want cats hanging out 200 feet from people's houses, laying around in the brush, listening to people, listening to engines and dogs bark and whatever else that goes on at a house or a farm. So is that normal cat behavior, or is that some level of habituation?
I got you. All right. That kind of answers my not well articulated question of meaning. Are you curious about, is that just like ambivalence to human presence a factor of just exposure to humans, or do you think it might be innate in cats? But you're going to probably explain how you're going to find that out.
Well, we hope so.
Yeah.
Whether or not we find out if it's just normal cat behavior that's innate to cats, or if it's a learned behavior, I don't know if we'll pin that down necessarily. But we are going to know whether or not we can change that behavior.
Okay.
And modify the way they respond after being chased around by dogs and yelled at by people and different things.
Okay.
You guys are in Montana, you know, where they chase cats around. I'm sure any cat that gets within Bozeman city limits probably has some eyes on it pretty fast. If there's snow, especially, there's an active community of hound hunters there that are going to go chase that cat and get a look at it. They probably won't kill it, particularly if it's a female, but those cats, they get looked at a lot. They get chased around, harassed by hound hunters. Washington doesn't have that. We're chasing cats that have very, very likely never been pursued by a dog.
Okay.
We're chasing cats that have probably never had a negative interaction with a person at all. So that's another one of the questions is...
Yep. Because it's been how many years since they banned lion hunting with dogs in Washington?
Over 20 now.
Okay.
I think 24. I think they banned it in 96, if I remember right.
So long enough ago where there's no cat living today that remembers those times.
Yeah. Yeah. Any cat that was legally pursued, and, you know, I say that because I don't know if people are out bootlegging around or chasing cats. That used to be a problem right after they made it illegal, there were still a lot of hound hunters around, and they were pretty upset about it, and I think that probably happened more then. The hound hunting ranks in Washington now are pretty slim. There's not a lot of people that still keep dogs because the opportunities are really tough.
Okay, so you get curious about this. Like, why do these cats just not care? What's your next step?
Well, we started to kind of think about ways to protect, you know, the farms and pets and small livestock that we kind of suspected are going to get picked off by cats. And a lot of times, a real common narrative when we showed up at the site of a depredation would be this landowner that would say, you know, oh yeah, such and such saw this cat a couple days ago, and my kid saw it when he was walking to the bus yesterday, and you know, it's been around. But there's no method to track those cats down and do anything about them. They're just sightings, right? And it's kind of a meaningless metric. So the state wasn't really responding to a sighting because that's just a cat being a cat. Until it actually does something, there's no real reason for them to send somebody out to chase it and get a look at it. So I kind of got to thinking like, all right, well, if that cat's hanging around this farm for a couple of days and, you know, showing up on whatever porch or something like that, that's probably going to cause a problem sooner or later. It's obviously showing that it's not that concerned about people and noise and all the things that we have going on a farm. So the project then kind of got started like, all right, so when these cats show up and they're being sighted, I want to know about it and I want to come out and chase them and see if they come back to that spot. So initially it was a little bit of a, you know, geographic thing, but really it's a stretch to think that that cat's going to make a connection between it hanging around a farm and then all of a sudden, you know, 12 hours later, here comes these dogs and popping up a tree, and then here comes these people yelling at it and stressing it out. It's a stretch for the cat to make that connection back to that original sighting that might have been the previous day. So it really became more of a behavior study. How does this cat respond over time if we do this? You know, how does it respond to this stimuli, which in this case is your voice, Steve, over time if we pursue it and give it this negative interaction every time it hears that human voice?
Yeah, I love that you're using this podcast.
Who is gonna? Who cares enough about this research, Bart, to pay for it?
It's a good question. No, it's a shoestring operation right now. We're looking for funding. If you guys know any place to scrounge money,
yeah, imagine like the Los Angeles Pet Owners Association.
Okay, so you're saying this is on your own dime, and that the Washington Game and Fish isn't helping you out.
Yeah, but Bart works for the tribe.
No, I know, but he also does work for Game and Fish, correct? With these problem animals?
So a lot of the Fish and Game is the manager of the wildlife in the state. Kalispell Tribe has a pretty keen interest in cougar stuff right now because we have a reservation that's smack dab in the middle of prime winter habitat, and we have had years where we've had terrible problems with cougars on the reservation, in yards, at bus stops, and all the things that you hear about. So my initial kind of seed money came from the UCUT group, which is the Upper Columbia United Tribes. It's a consortium of five tribes in North Idaho and Northeast Washington. So that was the initial seed money for the research. I've got a couple of grants outstanding right now, but it doesn't cost that much what we're doing. Like I said, we bought six collars. I've got that W, Buddy Woodbury's company, doing the Garmin stuff for me. He's been real super helpful with all the tech questions that I've got with Garmin, and we're using their equipment. I think it's on loan, but they're not going to get a lot of it back because it just gets trashed out there in the woods for a month on a cat. We're just kind of piecing it together as we go.
Okay, so keep going on the story here. So you explain how you work and how you use this podcast to help.
Okay, so as we're designing this project, we're starting to, you know, one question tends to lead to another, and that's where we ended up. So we have all these questions starting to pile up, and all the protocol that we ended up settling on to try to answer as many questions as possible, I'll try to describe succinctly. But we capture a cat that's been sighted. So Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, the enforcement group, is cooperating with us pretty well. So they are the ones fielding the calls for sightings or depredations or whatever.
Okay.
So when there's a cat hanging around a farm or a home that's spotted under a porch or wherever that it probably shouldn't be, they call me. And then we get our stuff together and go get a look at this cat. And we go capture the cat. It's, you know, Bruce is volunteering for the project and put a ton of hours into it. And I will go out and capture this cat and get it in a tree. And then we make a decision if it's a cat that we want to add to the project. We're really looking for adult cats. We don't want sub-adults that are still with their mom. And we don't want lactating females. I don't want to disrupt a cat that's actively nursing or feeding young. So we take this cat, we end up, we dart it, put a collar on it, and we put a...
Explain that darting process real quick.
So we just use a, it's an air gun, and we're working on a drug formulation I think I'm actually really excited about, because a lot of people use ketamine, xylazine on cats. We're trying to save some money. We're trying to do some things different and test some different stuff and use a safer drug. Ketamine's a little bit dangerous, and it's also evidently a street drug that we have to be really careful about. So we're using a drug called BAM that we've used on sheep successfully. So we're testing that on the cats, and it seems to be working real well. So we're darting this cat.
Uses ketamine, what are they after?
I have no idea. Phil? I know for cats, it looks like it would suck when you see a cat under ketamine, because they're like rigid and uncomfortable, and then when they recover, they're drooling and their head's bobbing around, and they're just staggering. It looks awful.
Give a little squirt in your mouth, because you don't want to replicate that experience that the cat's having.
It does not look like they're having a good time at all.
I was really hoping you guys were gonna go into like the marijuana side of things, like super shot of CBD.
Just get them high. Yeah.
Yeah.
We could try. People use ether and knock cats out. I've heard of the old timers doing that. Like starting fluid, basically, they'll knock a cat out to get it out of a trap or something.
Got you. And then did you hear the story we had on this show one time about a guy that got accidentally shot by the tranquilizer gun?
No.
Yeah. It was quite an ordeal for him.
Yeah. That can be very dangerous.
They had to pack him down on a mule.
Really?
They had to load the guy up on a mule and pack him out of the mountains. Thought he was going to die. Got shot by the dart.
That's another reason I want
to
use
the
BAM.
Drug you're trying to experiment with is BAM?
Yeah. I would get that wrong if I told you. It's a three-drug formulation. It's butorphanol, I think atipamazole, and metatomidine. So it's a three drugs mixed to one. It's made by a wildlife vet in Colorado.
Okay.
It's a great product. Super safe. They're using it on moose and sheep and deer and other things. The one thing it does have, it's reversible. So if I was to dart myself, I could also reverse myself.
Oh, no kidding. So you could carry a vial of antidote.
Right. So I have a reversal agent. I'll get back to darting the cat, and we'll talk about reversing it and everything else. But so to dart the cat, we get it in the right tree. So if it's in a super high tree, someplace where it's going to get injured if it comes out of the tree, we'll jump it out of that tree and put dogs on it right away. So they put a lot of pressure on it and get it to grab another tree. When you do that, typically that cat's running from those dogs and it's going to grab the first tree it can get to. It's less likely that it's going to pick a great big tree and climb way to the top.
How do you prompt it when it finds a tree and it goes into a tree and it's the wrong tree because it's going to fall, presumably, right? It's going to fall and get hurt if you tranquilize it.
Right.
How do you willfully prompt it to jump to another tree, to jump to the ground?
So we've done it a couple of ways. Sometimes you can just bang on that tree with a stick or a log, and I think that vibration drives them a little bit crazy, and they'll just climb out. If they haven't been treed very much and they are pretty nervous, it's easy to get them to jump. We also carry a paintball gun, and you can rattle the tree above them or actually shoot the cat with the paintballs, and they'll come out of the tree that way too.
And try to get them in a better tree.
Right.
Yeah.
So I want them I don't want them over about, 35 feet high. And then we carry climbing equipment because sometimes they go down in the tree. But so I deliver the dart and we get this tarp hung out, and it's like you would expect. It's a big, I don't know if it's canvas or not, but it's that kind of heavy cotton material.
Hey, do you have to hit them in any special spot with that dart?
I always try to hit them in the hamstring. You can shoot them in the shoulder, but there's just more connective tissue and more likelihood of an injury. So I always try to shoot them right in the hamstring. The butt.
Got it.
And that's a big muscle group. I'm using a 1.5-inch long needle, so it's a big needle, and you have to get into a pretty deep muscle. So these are just pressurized darts that are reusable. So once the dart hits, typically the dart comes out of the cat in the tree. It's not barbed or anything like that. So the drug's delivered. Dart typically falls out of the tree. We get our tarp up and just watch, and that cat, about half the time, they go down and they're stuck in the tree, and we have to climb up tie a rope around them and push them out of the tree down into the tarp.
How long does it take to put that cat to sleep?
That depends. Typically, so the BAM itself is going to take like 10 minutes, which seems like an eternity when you're out there. We have started adding a really small dose of ketamine to the BAM. And it's a low dose ketamine. It's a 100 milligrams per milliliter ketamine. So it's like the stuff they use on horses. We put just a whisper of that in there and that knocks them out way faster. So those two drugs really work together well and they'll go down in about 2.5 minutes with that.
Okay. And then guys are like firemen catching someone jumping out of a window.
Pretty much. Yeah. We'll tie the tarp up, hold the tarp up in the corners, do whatever and catch it when it lands. So you had a funny dart story. I had one of those just a week ago. I was shot a cat, and we look at the cat through the scope of our air rifle, you know, and I could see the plunger wasn't all the way down on the dart, which is a concern because it means there's still half the drugs in the dart. It also means the cat only got half the delivery. So we're wondering if we're going to have to dart him again. And he started looking like he was going to come out of the tree. He was getting pretty heavy. His head was hanging. So we got in position with the dart and the cat started moving around. And I wasn't paying attention to the cat. I was looking at the tarp and I felt something. I thought a stick landed on me and I looked down and that dart had come out of the tree and stuck in my palm like a lawn dart with half the drug still in it and the sleeve was off and it's pressurized. I was like, oh my God, this is going to be embarrassing.
But it didn't dose you?
It didn't. I cleaned it up. Of course, nowadays everybody has hand sanitizer in every pocket. So I pulled it out and smeared some hand sanitizer in there and kept a pretty close eye on it. And I don't think I got any of the drug at all. I didn't feel like I did anyway.
So you've got a lot of practice shooting cats with darts though, right? Like how many cats? This is a two-part question I'm teeing you up for.
What's the first part of the question?
How many cats have you darted?
I am not sure where I'm at right now. So we have, probably 20 cats so far. We're permitted for 35 this year.
Oh, and in your whole career? I figured you would have shot more than that.
Yeah, beyond this study.
No, I didn't really shoot very many when I was helping the state. That was typically their biologist delivering the drugs on that.
Oh,
I was just doing the capture part with the dogs.
Gotcha.
So this project's really most of my cat darting. I've darted sheep and deer and some other things, but... for this one, probably 20 cats and probably, I think 3 or 4 of those cats we've had to handle 3 different times, most of them twice.
Wow.
So I don't know how many darts I've delivered, 50 or 60, I guess.
And since they're reusable, have you identified the lucky dart? Like, what is the dart that comes out of the box?
Oh, lucky.
You're like, that one is going to, that puts Tabby down.
We have identified a couple of unlucky darts. I don't know. We don't have one that I like better than the others, but we always test them before we load the drugs. And sometimes those, you know, it's just a syringe, right? And sometimes those plungers get sticky and things like that. So we're always testing them and that has helped. But I had a terrible time. The first cat we treat, I missed twice before I got a dart in it. And the gun was shooting like a foot high. And I sighted the gun in on the flat like a total rookie move, you know. I just took it out in the lawn and sighted it in, and that's a very different trajectory than shooting almost straight up into a tree. So I was shooting over the cat, and it was launching these $18 darts full of, you know, $40 worth of drugs out into the stratosphere. So that was embarrassing, but we've got it dialed in now. I haven't missed a cat in a long time.
Yeah, good for you. Okay, so the cat falls out of the tree, lands on the trampoline. The cotton.
Yep. If a lot of times the cat comes out, still has some life in it, we tie it up. We just put a loop around its hind leg and tie it to the tree and let the drugs take the full effect. The dogs are tied back 100 or so yards to kind of lower stimulation. We tell people to be quiet and not talk, not stimulate the cat. They're really paying attention. Like visual stimulation will really bother them when their anesthesia is taking effect, and it will slow down the effects of the drugs. So we get a head cover on them as soon as it's kind of safe, right? And their head can still be up. They really want to get away from you at that point. They're not like trying to fight or anything. They just want to walk away. So we get a head cover on, and that really seems to subdue them, and they relax pretty fast once their eyes are covered. So we collar the cat. We're using the regular survey collar that you see on every wildlife project, right? The big GPS collar weighs like whatever. I don't know how many grams, but they're big. And on that, we're affixing the Garmin unit. So we're putting that other Garmin T5 tracking unit. It's basically the same thing you get from a same thing for a dog, right? We're affixing that to the Vectronix survey collar. And with that unit, we're able to get 2-second data on the cat. And then
what does that mean?
So on the survey collar, I'm getting data every 4 hours. So okay. I kind of have an idea where that cat lives on a 4-hour rotate. You know, every 4 hours I get a point. So over time, you get really good data, but only have a month. I'm not trying to determine home range or any of that stuff. I just want to know where that cat's at right now. So with this Garmin, it's the same thing I use on a dog. I have a handheld that shows that cat's location, shows my location, and shows the dog's location. So when I'm in the field, I have this real-time data on the cat, and I know within 2 seconds where that cat's at and when it's moving and how fast.
So you basically, I mean, you know right where he is at every moment.
I know exactly. Yeah. It's so to my knowledge, it's the first time anybody's done this with cats anyway, with that kind of data and that kind of field capability.
But so, Bart, why even attach the regular GPS collar?
Because battery life is an issue with the Garmins. We're still working on how long, we don't really know how long a battery will last. In the winter time, it seems like we're getting about a month out of one of those batteries. Right now it's extended out to about 6 weeks, I think. But I just didn't want to have a cat running around with a dead collar on it and have no way to go recapture the cat. So that normal survey collar has the 4-hour data and VHF capability. So it lasts, you know, I get 2 years of battery life out of that unit. Compared to that other collar where I'm getting 2-second data and this is going through the battery fast.
When this cat wakes up from getting tranquilized, I know this isn't the object of your study, but when you tranquilize the mountain lion, you put the collar on it, it's effective immediately, right? You can just start tracking him instantaneously.
Yes.
How far does he go? And how much time goes by before he's back to like acting like a mountain lion?
With the BAM, the recovery is fast. I think they start acting normal far more quickly than they do with a ketamine capture. I think that ketamine capture really it causes, you know, for lack of a better term, a hangover for that cat that lasts a day or two. With the BAM, we see movement pretty quick. Once they recover, because we reverse it, remember, so we reverse that cat, and within about 3 minutes, that cat is on its feet and running away from us.
And how far will he run before he goes? Like, how far does he haul ass before he, like, chills out again?
Not far. Maybe 100 or 2 yards. I mean, they're not
very far.
That's
it. Doesn't just run for miles just to get out of there.
Huh. Nope. So they move away from us, and we get out of there. And so before I leave, I put that Garmin collar to sleep mode. So that saves the battery life. And when I want to go find that cat again, I use the VHF on the Vectronix collar. I get close and I use my handheld Garmin unit to just wake that collar up. So it's in wake mode and then I start generating that 2-second data. So I'm not logging data all the time. It's only when it's awake. So it's kind of a nice function to save battery on that unit.
So how much time will elapse before you go back to look at it?
I've been trying to give them at least 5 days after capture to go have another look at that cat to recapture it.
And typically, how far away are they from where you've originally caught them?
You know, we've had a couple of cats that live on the same mountain the whole time. We've studied them. And then we've had others that bounce around, you know, 6, 8, 10 miles over the course of that week. So it just really depends on the cat and also the time of year. You know, the cat that lived on one mountain the whole project was in the middle of winter, is up north. Up by Colville, Washington, deep snow, had a nice piece of winter range for deer, and that cat was just living right above the deer. It had no reason to leave.
And then after you tranquilize them and collar them, what's the soonest you've seen them actually kill a big game animal or kill a large animal after that?
I'm not sure. I haven't really paid attention to that. I know one cat, we collared her. So we were approaching her to call her, and she had just killed a deer. The deer was actually hadn't even been dragged to a cache. It was laying in an open field, basically, or meadow up in the mountain. So she had just made a kill. We collared her, and later that day she was on that deer and drug it into the brush and ate on it for about a week. So,
oh, so pretty quick turnaround to going back to normal. Yeah.
Yeah, she started acting normal pretty quick.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. Like, kills.
If you did that to a person, dude, they'd be whacked out for the longest time, man.
Yeah, they'd be seeing a counselor.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we would be thinking about it too much. She's just, her belly started growling, and she said, oh, yeah, that's right. I killed a deer this morning. All right, yep. I think I can ask a good prompting question. What are the, like, the data points then that you're actually looking for now that you've probably got the data point of, like, where you caught it, right? And that's your start. And then, so what are the data points that then next time you go in that you're capturing?
So there's three important data points that I'm gathering, and that's more important than the actual point is the distances in between them. So when a week after we put a collar on a cat, we approach that cat, and when I'm within about 400 yards, I start the podcast on an 80 decibel little Bluetooth speaker.
Do you play the intro? Because it's going to think its tree is falling down.
I don't play the intro. No. It's actually, I've only used like two podcasts. I'm not out there that long. So
so you don't pick your favorite parts?
No, I've just got one podcast that's been playing for the cats for quite a while.
Okay. Well, do you mind me asking real quick, like what's going on in the show?
It was the Polar Expedition show.
People eating each other and everything.
That probably turns a cat on,
man.
Yeah, they don't like that. And then the other one was that gentleman that wrote the book about Davy Crockett.
Yeah.
Which, I listened to. I mean, I want to read that book now after listening to you at 80 decibels for an hour and a half talk about it. It's like, I feel like I have to read it. So I approached the cat from about 400 yards. I'll start that podcast. And I start approaching the cat on basically a direct line. And I know exactly where it's at. I've got it on the handheld, and I know where I'm at. And I don't have dogs with me or anything else. I'm just walking up to the cat with this human voice playing. The important data is...
And hold on, back up. Uh-huh. And he's like in a predictable place. Are you like, oh, he's in a cliff, or he's in, you know what I mean? Or are they just like out in just weird places?
If it's in the middle of the day, which we're trying to capture cats or recapture cats in the middle of the day, it's a pretty predictable place. And we're starting to make some connections that way about when cats are on the move compared to when cats are in a bed, how they respond.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But there's a little bit of individuality that way too. Some cats are a little more comfortable laying out in a less of a thicket, and some cats really hole into some gnarly little thickets or rock overhangs and things like that.
So they like to lay in the thicket.
There are some cats that lay in a thicket that's like impenetrable thickets.
Oh, no kidding.
And when they're in one of those, they feel very safe. You can walk right up to them.
Got you. Okay, so I didn't mean to derail you there. I was just curious about...
No.
But so what's the more open location look like?
A penetrable thicket.
Okay, so it's never like he's just laid out in the sun in the middle of a 100-yard grassy meadow.
No, we do find them laying in open forest on occasion, but if they are, it's like at the base of a tree with, you know, heavy with branches.
Yeah,
and stuff
I feel like
that.
When we chased those, the first day we chased lions with you in northern Idaho, didn't we find two beds that were in a pretty open fir forest?
Yep.
Yeah, that was open forest. They were up against, you know, old growth cedar trees, though. Yeah. I mean, they had some cover there still.
Cedars.
So they like some cover. They like a thicket. They like a rocky spot.
Yeah, we find them in all of those things. Overhung rocks. We've had a couple of cats that we walked right up to that were in overhung rocks. We actually had one Monday that was we got within 30 yards of. She was laid up in a rock pile.
Okay, so you start playing this thing and walking toward them, and you start playing it at 400 yards.
Yeah, 400 yards. I turn the podcast on. I approach them in the most direct line.
How loud is that? How loud is it for you? Like, you're playing it to it's like that's an annoying level for you.
Yeah. It's annoying. It's an outside voice for sure.
Okay.
Um, it's not a shout necessarily, but it's a loud talk for sure.
Okay.
If we were walking in the woods talking at that level, it would be annoying probably.
Got it.
So they're hearing it from quite a ways. So as we approach this cat, the important data that I grab is how close do I get to the cat before it gets to its feet and leaves. So I grab, at that point I stop, I get my location, pin that, I get the cat's location, I pin that, and then I just watch that cat and I keep the speaker playing and I just stand still and I let that cat move away however it chooses. Whatever that flight looks like, however much energy it wants to put into escaping my approach. And the cat moves away, and I get, typically that happens within about 10 minutes. And once that cat stops moving for, I don't have a set amount of time, but once it's hanging out in an area and not really going anywhere, I call that the end of the mobilization, and I grab that distance. So the two important measurements really are the distance from me, the stimuli, and the distance of the flight. And then I hop on the radio. I walk up to where that cat was laying around. I hop on the radio and tell Bruce, kick the dogs loose. The dogs are now trained to like track me. If I ever get lost, the dogs are going to find me in a second. They know what's going on now. So they track me to the site of the cat's bed. And once they get there, they take off and go tree that cat.
What are the distances like? The cat's responding at what distance typically?
So we are seeing those distances extend over the course of the project for pretty much every cat. The first time we approach a cat, so Monday was an exciting day. Monday was the first cat that I've walked up on and actually looked at before it ran away from me. And it's the first hazing, it's kind of what we're calling this, the first hazing event. The cat had been captured once. It was pretty calm at capture. So last Monday, I went out, I walked up to that cat, and I'm watching the GPS, and it's pretty thick there, not terribly thick. You can certainly see, 40 or 50 yards in the forest. And I'm watching the GPS. I'm like, man, I'm getting pretty close to this cat. He ought to be.
It's like that scene. It's like that scene in Red Dawn when the dudes in the white suits, the Ruskies in the white suits, start tracking that kid down.
Right. Yeah. It was unnerving. I'm looking at my GPS unit like, is this thing updating right? Like, what's going on here?
Do you get nervous? Do you get nervous around mountain lions?
I had my gun out. I had my gun out of its holster.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, I was nervous. I was close. I got within 19 feet of him.
Holy smokes. He's just laying there listening to the podcast. He's like, dude, this is fascinating.
Yeah, I can't get enough of this guy. So he was bedded underneath the kind of a leaning log, and I hopped up on top of the log to get a better view and get a little bit of elevation. And when I did, the end of the log moved, and I think that unnerved him, and he ran out from underneath that. So that's the first one that I've actually watched run away.
Wow, man.
And then he ran
19 feet.
Sorry, to be clear, this was the first time you had gone in
right
after this cat.
So this cat, okay. This is the first time it's been exposed to this stimuli. So it ran off and only went 75 feet and stopped and would not move. And I'm like,
really?
Now I'm unnerved at this point. So I'm hollering and I'm watching the GPS very closely to make sure it's not circling me or coming back to me or something. Because it knows I'm there. It has seen me. It's hearing me. And now it hears me hollering at it over the podcast. And it sat there for a long time. I mean, several minutes at 75 feet. And finally, I'm like, well, I guess we have to turn the dogs loose. That's its flight. That's what it's going to do. It's not going to run from me.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I got you. So you mark down that his flight is 75 feet.
Yeah. It's pretty close. So the dogs treat it within about 400 yards. And, at the first hazing event, we shoot them with a paintball gun. We tie all the dogs back, take them back to the truck, and we shoot that cat with a paintball gun to give it to reinforce that negative stimuli and holler at it, and kind of try to stress it out a little bit, that first capture event. So I'll see what he does. We're going to go after him again next week, and I'll probably take somebody with me this time, just because.
And presumably,
he's going to get out of there, yeah. That has been our experience. The first time we approach a cat, they let us get quite close. We have not had one flee from outside of 100 yards yet. So we're within 100 meters of anything right now the first time. And we have complete data, I think, on 8 cats now. And pretty much across the board.
Complete meaning that you've done it 4 or 5 weeks in a row?
Yes. So that's cats that have been collared, hazed 4 or 5 times, and then uncollared and released.
And are you seeing that it grow every time?
Not every time. We do have a couple of negative data points. We have a couple of cats that let us get a little bit closer, you know, on the 3rd or 4th event. Some of those are easily explained. One of those cats was sitting down by a creek in a thicket, probably didn't hear us with that running water right next to it. Let us get pretty close. Another one was up with a big tom, 175-pound cat, that had a female, and they were laid up in a rock pile together, and he let me get quite close before they mobilized.
Which is to say as well that she let you get quite close.
That was an interesting deal for sure, because he left first. He was in a little town called Ione up north, and he was in a woodshed when we darted him. Actually, he was in a woodshed, and we couldn't get him out. We shot him with a slingshot to get him to run out of the woodshed, and I couldn't get a dart in him when he was running out. And he went into a carport and was hiding under a boat, and I tried to get a dart in him there, and he squirted out the back of that and went under a deck, and we ended up having to dig, it's deep snow, it's chest-deep snow. We had to dig a tunnel kind of down underneath the deck, and I got a dart in him there. So that cat had some experience with people, and he lived in very close proximity to a little town. And the first time we went after him, he was up in these rocky, cliffy, this terrible spot to walk around and hunt. And, you know, in a GPS unit, you're looking at data from overhead, you know, so 15 yards might mean 100 or 200 vertical feet if it's cliffs, which is in this case is what it was. So that data is difficult to explain. Yeah, I got within 40 meters of him, but he was uphill of me in this overhang with a female that, you know, line of sight would have been 100 meters or something. So
yeah, I got you.
Difficult. So he left, and I circled around, and I got up on top of the cliff, and I found his tracks, and I was sitting on his tracks. And at this point, I didn't know there was another cat there. So I was sitting on his tracks just kind of watching the Garmin unit and filling out my data sheet and grabbing data that I needed. And he got out a few hundred yards, and I still had the podcast playing, and I hear something to my side, and I look over, and there that female is walking on his track straight at me, maybe 15 feet from me, and slips down through that same little crack in the rocks that male had just used to escape. It kind of seemed like without a care in the world about me.
Noise because you're still playing the noise.
Oh, yeah.
She's walking toward the noise.
Yeah, she walked right up close to me, but it was, yeah, her desire to follow that Tom's tracks was pretty strong. She pretty much ignored me to do that. And we got eyes on him twice before he went in a tree that day. He was just a pretty bold cat.
I'm surprised that I don't picture you're going to have a continued problem funding your work.
I don't think so. It would seem that a lot of
people would be like really interested in this and how to, because the thing about cat, it's not like rats, right? It's not like where you have just thousands and thousands of them and there's nothing you can do. Like, what do you have mountain lion problems or mountain lions that you want in areas where they're imperiled and not doing well? You're talking about like a small number of animals. So you could actually go through and give them some white glove service, so to speak, and be targeted about it, and it would still make sense, you know? I mean, because there's so few of them. It's not insurmountable to go into an area that has a lot of lion problems and adjust some lion behavior.
Right. Yeah, and I had a biologist from California reach out to me, and he's got some interest in replicating the project down near San Francisco on one of the big reserves that they have, a lot of what they believe are habituated cougars that are kind of just laying around in day use areas and sort of don't have a care in the world about people. And I don't tend to make a whole bunch of promises about what we can do, but I did promise him, like, if there's a cat laying in a day use area, I promise I can change that cat's behavior to not do that anymore. Like, we can adjust that cat's attitude really quickly with dogs and paintballs.
Have you messed with, I know that, like, I support using the podcast. I think it's a great idea. It's a great touch. But Have you experimented with other stimuli? Like, do they hear like a dog, for instance? Do they hear frequencies that humans can't hear?
I don't know that. I have considered using the sound of dogs barking rather than a human voice to approach the cat and see how they respond. Not like a hound's bang, but like, you know, a border collie yapping around or something that a cat's going to hear, I mean, fairly regularly. If we get to a point in the project where we have good enough data and solid enough data with the human voice stimuli, we will switch to another sound, but it will probably be either like the sound of equipment droning on like a four-wheeler or like a dog barking or something that cats are going to hear that would have a management. It'd be a management action, right? Like something that you could tell people like, yeah, once we do this, this cat's probably not going to go close to your barking dogs or whatever.
I had a friend that used to design soundscapes in films. And, you know, when you're watching a movie, you know, and there's people sort of like driving around and you're hearing the sounds of the city, he would like design those just the ambient sound, you know, in films. So yeah, like just that you'd make a soundscape of just human activity, you know, doors shutting, kids, whatever, people yelling at their kids. It'd be like my house.
Yeah.
And get them used to that noise.
Right. And then the obvious thing that, you know, if you, let's say you did this over the course of time in an area, it's a small area. This isn't something that I expect to happen across the whole region or something, but it would be interesting then to see how cats responded to just a speaker at a house or out in the woods, say, see how they moved around the landscape and see if they avoided that or just passed through like they always have.
And is there a thing you can do to them that they really, really hate?
Touch them. Yeah. If you can get contact with them, that paintball or anything like that just drives them crazy. They hate that.
They don't like it.
No.
You change your shot placement when you're doing the negative reinforcement. Like aim for like point of the shoulder or something that's gonna
tip of the nose
bruise. Yeah.
Yeah. When I'm shooting a paintball, I was kind of experimenting with this permanent paint that foresters use. They mark trees with this stuff and it lasts quite a while on a tree. So I bought some of these fancy paintballs with permanent paint in them and I wanted to see how long that would last on a cat. Just so if we had a cat that was causing trouble in an area, a sighting, I didn't have a collar available or whatever. All right, we'll go mark this thing. And if it, you know, without having to drug it and handle it, we're not going to put an ear tag in it or anything else. If that cat shows up, hopefully the people that see it would be able to say, yeah, as it turns out, it had a bunch of blue paint on its side. So I wanted to see how long that paint would last. And it turns out it's not that effective. It comes off fairly quickly. But I was trying to shoot the cat forward in the body where it wouldn't be able to reach back and lick that stuff off. So I was shooting him in the front of the shoulder, neck, and back. It's kind of where I was aiming. But I don't know if that, I mean, anybody that's played paintball knows those things. They sting. They're not going to break skin on a cougar for sure, but they do sting. And making contact with that cat drives them crazy.
Have any of the cats that you got right now, how often do you have a cat that has a collar on it and then it gets killed somehow or another while, like, unrelated to your activity?
So that big tomcat that I was talking about in the cliff just a minute ago, he got killed. He took off after that day and walked all the way into Canada about 10 miles north of the border and got himself killed by a legal hunter up there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I got that collar back. And then another cat was down here close to Spokane. It was a cat that
Were you pissed that the guy shot your collared lion?
No, I don't care. It was a whatever. That's the deal. He's a legal hunter.
Was he aware that it had a collar?
Oh yeah, no, he knew it had a collar. I think he was a little bit nervous. He was a little bit reticent to call me. And you know, on the collar it has my name and phone number and says whatever, please call if found. It took a little. I actually saw it on Facebook before. I think I actually reached out to him first. But I think
I'm not mad. I just want my collar back.
Hey, by any chance, that collared lion you shot.
Right. Well, it's got, you know, that's a $1,500 collar plus the Garmin collar plus all the data that's on it, which is, you know, that's three or four days of work worth of data that's stored on that Garmin unit that I really want. So yeah, I called him and I was like, hey, look, congratulations. That's a big cat. I can send you some pictures of him if you want, you know, pictures of him in a woodshed and pictures of him in a tree and whatever, pictures of him with anesthetized and whatever else. So once he knew that I was not mad and I was also a hunter and, you know, congratulated him on such an awesome cat, he softened up a little bit and sent me my collar back.
And that was a 175 pounder.
Yeah, it was a really nice cat.
Oh man.
It's cooler for him too, because you can be like, I can tell you exactly what that cat's been doing. You don't have guess.
Oh yeah. He'd be like, and then he ran over to this tree, and then he ran over to this tree.
That's right. Yeah, he had an ear tag in too. I don't know if I'm sure they pulled that out for the taxidermist, but get a little jewelry too.
Wow.
And remind me again, how many cats you got running around right now?
Got five on the air right now. So I haven't really got into a couple parts of the project that are fairly important. One of them, so once that cat runs, I'm getting screwed on this deal as far as seeing cougars, other than happening upon one here and there.
I don't understand. What do you mean by that?
I'm not even going to the tree anymore. So Bruce and the other gang walks to the tree, and I am now measuring the habitat. So I'm grabbing all this data from the flight of the cat. So once that cat runs away, once that cat runs, I measure the distance. You know, let's say it goes 200 yards or whatever, meters. I then lay out a tape and I measure the slope. So did that cat run uphill or downhill? I grab a slope measurement and then I grab the basal area measurement. So it's a forestry measurement that kind of tells you the forest type. It'll give you a rough idea how wooded it is. And then also shrub component and, you know, if it's a thicket or if it's running through fairly open stuff or down a road or whatever. So I'm trying to describe then how much energy that cat used to escape.
Are you taking note of the wind too? Wind direction?
I have a wind noise factor that's just 1 through 5.
And no, I mean, does he play the wind when he runs?
Oh, I haven't paid attention to that.
Dude, I'd add that to your stuff, man.
Yeah.
Does he? Because maybe he always maybe he always goes into the wind.
It would be an interesting thing to start to test some of that as far as circling upwind or downwind of him too.
I should have been a scientist, man.
You should have been a scientist. You should come along.
Dude, I'd have all kinds of science things I'd figure out.
Yeah. That'd be fun to circle, give him the wind advantage and see if they mobilize more quickly or not. Yeah. So I'm grabbing all of this habitat data for the escape path, and I'll use that to kind of help describe distance with, you know, capital D distance then. So rather than just a linear measurement, it will include all of this other stuff. Like if it ran up and over a cliff, that might only be a couple hundred yards, but that's definitely more energy to escape than just jogging down a two-track road. And then I'm also grabbing some data when we get to the tree, kind of measuring the behavior of that cat. And we've kind of had to develop this scale, but I think it'll be useful when we're done. We'll have a lot of it. How that cat's responding in the tree, is it snarling? Is it urinating? Is it jump bailing out and finding a different tree? How high is it in the tree? Is it moving around? Whatever. So we measure all that stuff for number of times per 5 minutes that it's treed. And we're seeing that number change as well. The cats tend to, by the end of the project, tree quite a bit higher and be quite a bit calmer, where they're not dancing around in the tree. They kind of know the routine. By about the fourth or fifth time we're capturing them, it's like they just grab a tree before the dogs are very close to them, and they climb way up high, and they're just like laid out, relaxed when we get there.
That's not going to bode well for them when they're traveling like that one, when they're traveling into hunted areas. They're going to make them easy pickings.
Maybe. I mean, it might also have implications in wolf country, which almost everything in Northeast Washington is wolf country now. So I don't know if that will play out or how it would.
Oh yeah, because you were mentioning that you find that cats that have exposure to wolves, you were wondering if it changes their attitude about whether or not they need to get into a tree or not.
Yeah, maybe. I think that's well documented that a single wolf is trouble for a cat. Like is in trouble if it encounters a cat. A cat will kill a wolf when it gets the opportunity, as long as there's not a bunch of them. And I think it's not a far stretch to imagine those cats learning that on a single wolf a couple of times in their life, and then all of a sudden this single dog shows up that's half as big as a wolf yapping, and they're just like, well, I'll just kill that because I've done this before.
So a lion will kill a single wolf?
Yes.
Not vice versa?
Oh, one-on-one. It's a no contest. Lions are, yeah, they're deadly at all five ends.
Huh.
Yeah, that wolf doesn't have a chance.
Well, that's interesting.
I wouldn't think. I guess I don't know. I mean, unless it's a sub-adult lion or something else, an adult lion versus an adult wolf, I'd say lion every single time.
Yeah. So what's next, man?
Well, hold on. I feel like you told us about the negative changes in the a couple of the data points, right? When you went back subsequently, but what on average is the change after the hazing for the third, fourth, and fifth times you come in there with the podcast going?
Yeah. Good question. The biggest change almost always occurs on the second hazing. So that cat, the second time it happens, I think they're still pretty freaked out. And it's been 200 to 300% of both the flight initiation and the flight distance. And we've had some that like don't stop running. We've had some cats, once they mobilize, they run like 900 yards a long ways.
Whoa.
So they're getting out of there. By the end of the project, these cats, without exception, we haven't had any cat let us get closer over the course of the project. We've just had a couple, when I say a couple of data points, I mean like outliers. Like we caught this cat four times and one of them was a negative distance.
Yeah.
So of the, you know, let's say we have eight cats with full data, you know, 4 to 5 points each, you know, 95% of those points are positive, and 200 to 300% is a pretty standard increase.
So that's why you feel so confident if you had a problem lion that was hanging out at a day use area that you felt like you could go in there and do this for a month and that would cure that habit of his or hers.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, the other reason that second might be so significant, that second hazing event, that increase might be so significant, is because at the first hazing event, we shoot them with paintballs. If we did that every time, that distance might just continue to increase until as soon as that cat heard Steve's voice, it hauled ass.
Oh, so you guys don't continue that, the paintballs?
No, we just shoot it the one time.
Why is that?
I don't know. I kind of feel bad shooting them every time. Like, I don't know. I just need to learn whether or not it works. I don't need to torture a cat.
Yeah, yeah. You don't want to make a man-hater out of them.
Well, yeah, so... Again, I want this to have management implications where when a cat's hanging around a farm and it gets sighted, they can call somebody with dogs and say, all right, go tree this cat and shoot it with paintballs, and we have a reasonable expectation of how that cat's going to respond in the future.
If you give it a stimuli that it can associate.
Right. Well,
and then replicate that, then you have to turn around and replicate that stimuli to get the desired effect out of it.
Well, I don't think you would have to, I mean, I don't think, let's say, whatever, after this project's said and done and we get a call, hey, there's a cat on the edge of a neighborhood, can you go chase it out of there? I don't think we would have to go approach that cat with a voice recording or anything else. I think we could go capture that cat, bang on the tree, shoot it with paintballs, and it would make the association between our, because we're talking while we're at the tree. I mean, it's hearing human voices the whole time, right?
Yep.
It would make that association that way.
It is interesting though, because I mean, you said in the beginning that some of these cats were hanging out so close to these, you know, urban interface kill sites where they're likely hearing a lot of human voices too. So you're fighting against this kind of, maybe not a positive interaction, but it's kind of like this background noise of human ranch work, farm work. But I can still go down and pick off a alpaca or a dog or something like that. So
right. Yeah. And, you know, that's one of the misconceptions I'm having a terrible time with on this project. A lot of people think that I'm going out and trying to chase this cat away from a farm with the expectation that it's not going to come back to the farm or that area. And that's not really it. What I want is that cat to avoid all of these human associations. And I don't know if we'll get there or not. Not for all of the cats, not for all the time, but I think there is an argument to be made that the cats being messed with are going to behave better.
Is there a version of this you could attempt on grizzlies?
Not with my dogs. They do this.
Are they just hell on dogs? If you try to run a grizzly with dogs, they're just hard on the dogs.
I've never done it, but I have heard stories about people getting on them. And I guess they're long runners. They're straight line long runners. Like a black bear will tend to circle, and a grizzly bear will just line out and go. And then, of course, they don't climb. They just bay and fight. So, I mean, people certainly do it. There's like famous hound hunters from back in the day that collected bounties on grizzly bears by using dogs. And I don't think we have good records of how many dogs they went through over the course of that time, but probably a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, black bears are tough on dogs. A mean black bear is a tough thing for a dog to handle.
Have you lost any dogs lately?
No, we've had good luck with dogs. Actually, I've still got Whisper. She's 12. Nosy's 9. Radar died of cancer 2 years ago.
And what's the one that got mauled up pretty good?
Nosy. Yeah, she's hanging in there. She was with me this Monday. She treed 2 cats with me.
Does she just hate them now, though?
Oh, she hates them. Yeah, she was kind of a hateful little dog before that whole wreck. Now she's full of it.
I got go on with the dogs. I got a question for you. It's out there though.
Okay. Yeah. We had a litter of pups. Actually, you remember Bruce's had that big red dog, Gus. Yeah. We bred him back to Tipsy. Those were the 2 cats that were at your tree, Steve, Gus and Tipsy.
Okay.
So we bred those 2 dogs together. They were awesome. We have a good litter of pups out of them, and they've been on a lot of cats. Those pups are doing most of the work right now. I think they've seen, 63 cats so far since January 1st that we've treed. So they're getting a lot of exercise.
Cal, what's your question? You had a far out question?
Yeah, this would fall firmly in the final thoughts type of, I got this new neighbor, California guy.
Is this the guy that throws all the good stuff in the dumpster?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. Real nice guy. He's got a place that butts up to the Hearst Castle, which is now a California state park. And Hearst, William Randolph Hearst, tons of cash through the 20s, 30s, built up this incredible place. It had this giant zoo and wildlife menagerie. And there's all these stories going around that when the financial hard times of the 30s caught up to him, one solution that they came across was to release a bunch of animals, the animals that they couldn't give away. And my neighbor claims that they have trail camera pictures of the descendants of Hearst's jaguar population that have now crossbred with the California mountain lions in the area.
No.
And they are getting black mountain lions that are noticeably larger than your typical mountain lion. I have my doubts.
Come on.
Oh, I mean, if they're getting trail camera pictures, just ask them to produce those. Let's see it.
Does that exist though? Jaguar mountain lion hybrids or crossbreeding of any sort? Have you ever heard of that?
I've never heard of that. And they share range, they share habitat in the Southwest.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, we would probably know if that happened.
Yeah. Yeah, they share habitat like across the entirety of the jaguar's range.
Yeah, probably. I mean,
no, they do. I know they do. Now that I think about it.
But anyway, I give this guy your cell phone number and stuff. So.
Oh, good. Yeah. That's great.
All right, Bart, George, John, you got any more questions for Bart?
No, I'm good, Bart. Thanks for chatting with us.
Yeah, man. I hope your money comes through because it's interesting. But see, I'm trying to figure out what it means in general, because I don't know if it means, does it mean that this will be like a thing that winds up being used against people hunting mountain lions with dogs? Will National Geographic reports on this? Will they be able to twist it into people shouldn't be able to hunt mountain lions with dogs? I got to think this through for a minute.
I hope not. I mean, I think it's, ultimately, I want it to lead to another tool for wildlife managers that are dealing with potential public safety conflicts and depredation issues. You know, like that park or reserve down in California, I want them to have a tool to be able to say with some level of certainty, like, hey, look, we can save these cats' lives in the future. If these cats get in trouble, if they get in a mix-up with a person, they're going to die. Like, that's a certainty. In Northeast Washington, when a cat kills livestock, it dies. So if we can keep that from happening, and, you know, let's say it only works 75% of the time, that's a lot of cats that we can keep out there on the landscape and, you know, available to sport hunters and available for whatever other purpose.
That was a good little, I like that, man. That was a good little twist in the end. That was good. All right, Bart George, how long is it going to be till you come back on again and tell us what you're up to next? How long are you going to be doing this for and then go on to something else that might be interesting?
Well, I'll be working on this probably for another year or so. Still doing some caribou work. If you want to have a talk about caribou, there's still some in the Central Selkirks. I'm working with the International Caribou Foundation, trying to help out a group up at the Arrow Lakes, save a herd that's down to about 24 animals. Got some callers out on that herd this year, so we know that there's at least 9 cows up there and a couple of calves alive, but the census wasn't complete because of the damn shutdown stuff. Got in it. Canada also. So.
And then what about personal hunting? You hunting spring bear this year?
No, I usually hunt Idaho spring bears, and they won't let us come across the border nowadays. They cut off all the non-resident tag sales.
Oh, gotcha.
Washington, our season will be open here in a couple days for turkeys. I'll probably go try to pick a couple of them up on my way to work.
Are they letting non-residents come to Washington?
For what?
Turkeys.
For this
extremely late turkey season that you told us about.
Yeah, probably.
Come to Washington. Really hunt turkeys in June.
In June. Hunt turkeys in your flip-flops, man.
That's crazy. Yeah, I don't like hunting turkeys after May 1st. Once the mosquitoes are out and the ticks are out, which I've already found some of those, I kind of shy away from turkey hunting. But I'll probably try to get out. It's the only show in town right now for us.
And then last question. You're married, right?
Oh, yeah.
Two kids. Two kids.
I was getting to is where you're at with the kid thing right now.
Yeah, my wife and I have 2 boys. 2.5 and 7 months, so we're pretty busy. And Everett, the older boy, has been able to tag along on a few cougar hunts. He was in a backpack with me the other day when we treat a cat for work. So he knows the routine.
What's a 2.5-year-old say or do when they see a cat in a tree?
Well, the more concerning part was before we saw the cat. I was approaching the cat, had the podcast playing, and he's got a stick back there, and he's banging around, hitting everything with the stick as we're walking in the backpack. And he knows kind of what we're doing. He has an idea that we're out looking for a cougar, but he doesn't know the routine yet. So we're marching along, and he starts saying, "I see a cougar. I see a cougar." And I'm close to the cat. You know, I'm within about 60 yards of him. I'm like, shit, is this collar not working? Does he actually see a cougar? And I'm like trying to ask him where, and I can't see where he's pointing. And But he hadn't. He was just telling stories. So when we get to the tree, he's excited about it. I keep a distance. Obviously, I'm not handling cats with him. But when we get to the tree, we'll stay a little ways back and let Bruce do all the heavy lifting at the tree and then just call the dogs to us when we're done. But he's excited about it.
Good. Future scientist.
Yeah, maybe.
All right, man. Thanks again for joining us, Bart. We'll talk to you soon.
Later.
Thanks. See you, Bart.
Later.